This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode here at the Damage Report. I'm John Iderola. I'm in this building that's less abandoned than it was just a couple of days ago because TYT entered the nth phase of this year, and we are de-quarantining to some extent with a limited presence other than myself in the studio. If you were watching the main show, The Young Turks, yesterday, you might have seen that Anna Kasparian and myself did the show together here, although separated, and with a big thing of plexiglass right here separating us. And so things are changing for the better. We'll see. I don't know. But please bear with us as we go through this show because a lot has changed just from yesterday to today that we're going to try to adapt to. We're going to have an awesome guest joining us in just a little bit. Gary Chambers Jr., who you might have seen previously on the show, is going to be here very shortly. And we're going to be talking about a lot. Not only we're going to bookend the show today. That's how I've sort of set it up with Trump's final sort of pitch to the people, why you should go for him rather than for Joe Biden, and then Joe Biden's counter to that to some extent. And I think that these two stories, the beginning and the end of our show today, are going to basically sum up what this election is kind of about. And one of those two paths is going to win. So we're going to walk those paths together today. We're also going to talk about Lindsey Graham, some of his unfortunate comments recently. The pandemic. Are we entering into the third part of the first wave? It's kind of looking like it. We're going to break down the numbers. And Donald Trump, if he loses, is that the end for Donald Trump? Or could we see Trump 2024? We're going to be debating that a little bit later on and see if we can figure out what MAGA heads would think about a Trump return in 4 years. But before we get to all of that news, I did want to let you know, if you're joining us after like a week being away, the Damage Report now getting just a little bit of respect from TYT. We've got two shirts now up at Shop TYT, both a Damage Report shirt and a Dragon Squad shirt. You're seeing there the awesome dragon design that Carlos came up with. And so those are both available at Shop TYT. The response has been amazing, and that is great for me because I want TYT to make even more. And the better these first two do, the more likely that is to happen. I also wanted to let you know that TDR now has an Instagram page available at instagram.com/thedamagereport. So you can take a look at that. I think we're getting, are we ready? No, okay. So we're awaiting the entry of our guest, and I thought I saw signals there. I assured our producer that I would be very smooth about the transition. That's a promise I can't keep. I'm like the president in that regard. But anyway, so why don't we launch into our first topic? We're going to be talking about these two different paths. We're going to start off with Donald Trump. Let's do it. Donald Trump's final pitch to the American people is complicated, obviously, and we've been covering a lot of different facets of it. But one that he keeps coming around to is that he alone, amongst all politicians effectively in America, is the one whose brain is working good. So first of all, you need to know that he has been repeatedly saying, I say thank you. He's been repeatedly saying that Joe Biden is mentally shot. That's a refrain that he's come back to multiple times at rallies on the campaign trail. He's called him a dumb guy. And just recently, in his he was interviewed by Stuart Varney this morning. He was asked about the possibility of some sort of second stimulus being passed. And he was asked, what about Nancy Pelosi? What do you think about her negotiating strategy? And he said about her, she's got a lot of problems. She's got a lot of mental problems, and it's going to be very hard to do anything with her. So I get the message. Joe Biden's mentally shot. She's got mental problems. Only Donald Trump has got it together. And I'd like to demonstrate how together he is. Here is a video of the president trying to pronounce the word Burisma.
8 months after his alleged meeting with the Burmese executives. So this Burmese, they say, pronounce it Burmese. a real beautiful company.
So I don't know which part is better, the multiple swings and misses to pronounce Burisma, or the it's so infested his brain that he said and Visa at some point, like he had no idea what was going on. And there's two explanations for it. Neither really good for Donald Trump. And one is that despite the fact that Fox News has been talking about Burisma pretty much nonstop for over a year, and he's been watching Fox News nonstop for pretty much over a year, he can't remember the name of the company that supposedly is at the heart of one of the largest political scandals of this entire presidential election. Or it's that he does know what the name is, but he can't actually form the word in his mind. And so he does the thing that you just saw there that he's done many times. You've seen this at rallies. When he can't pronounce something, he tries to spin an explanation as to why he can't pronounce it. That someone was telling him to pronounce it a certain way, even though even in his story, they're telling him to pronounce it incorrectly. The actual answer is very simple. He's kind of losing it a little bit, whether from the various medications he's on for coronavirus or the fact that he's getting up in years. And that's fine. I'm going to fall apart way earlier than my mid 70s, but I'm probably not going to spend the years leading up to that talking about how literally everyone else's brain is melting. Now, joining us now to comment on this and other news, Gary Chambers Jr., welcome back to the Damage Report.
What's up, brother? Good to be with you.
Glad to have you back. Excited to talk about a number of different news stories. I don't know if you were able to hear that video of the president having a little bit of trouble getting his thoughts together, getting a word from his brain to his mouth. But what do you think about him lashing out at Joe Biden, Nancy Pelosi, pretty much everyone saying that they've mentally lost it? They've got mental problems.
I mean, let's be clear. This guy has more mental issues than any of the people he mentions, right? He consistently says inflammatory things. We know he doesn't read, okay? Like, we know he doesn't read. And that's why he can't pronounce the words, because he's not even taking the time to digest the information. He's just like a dude who sits in front of the TV who happens to be president, right? What is it called? Executive time? He gets to go and just watch the news for hours and hours. And so, you know, he's just a regurgitation of Fox News consistently. And Trump has been off his rocker from the beginning. But what we have seen from conservatives is they will excuse anything he does as long as he carries out their wishes, like this Supreme Court nominee, right? As long as you're going to pack the court, as long as you're going to rape the American people with taxes. Yeah, sure, we'll keep him here, right? As long as we're not doing anything for poor people and helping the least of these, then, you know, I don't care if he says racist, inflammatory things. I don't care if he can't actually pronounce the names of the words that he says. I don't care, right? Because he's serving my interests. And that's the sad part about it all is, you know, they know he's crazy. They know he's off his rocker, but he does what they want him to do.
Yeah, I would say that's one of the sad parts of all of this. There's a lot. There's so many sad parts of this. But again, welcome back to the show. I saw that the Twitch chat absolutely exploded as soon as your face came on screen. So that's awesome. He's, as you said, he's regurgitating what he hears on Fox News, but he's not even really committed to it. Like, you know, we talked on the show yesterday about the Fox Cinematic Universe, that they have all of these stories that only if you don't watch Fox, you have no idea what they're talking about. And like, I'm really into the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but I can pronounce Asgard. I know what Wakanda is. Like, you actually commit to it if you're going to be obsessed with these things, but he can't actually do that. And so this was a little bit before you came out on the show, but I basically said that we're going to start today's show with Trump, him lashing out insanely at his political opponents. That's sort of what he's got in this campaign. And we're going to have Joe Biden sort of a summary of his campaign a little bit later. But like, he's attacking people as mentally shot. He was just on Stuart Varney and he attacked Gretchen Whitmer as saying she wants to be a dictator. So if people are just tuning in to news and they've been out for a few weeks, there was a gang of domestic terrorists that wanted to kidnap her because she was a tyrant in their words. And what does Trump do after he finds out about that? He says she has to open up. She wants to be the dictator in Michigan. The people can't stand her. She was the target of a militia plot a week ago and he's demonizing her in the language of the militia. And so I guess the question I have to you, Gary, is considering the trouble he's having in the polls, is doubling down on this sort of thing, is this gonna work? Is his base all he's got? Should we fear that this actually will be successful?
So I don't trust the polls in like a very serious moment in American history. I do not trust the polls. I think that the racists who support Trump will lie to a pollster in a heartbeat because he was down in the polls in 2016. And so I think he is feeding to his base. I think that he is well aware of what he's doing and that Trump is, you know, going after the people who are most attentive to that bigotry, right? Because he needs them to show up. And so leading up to this election, I think he's gonna get worse. You know, I think he's going to be more inflammatory. I don't know why anybody's even surprised, right? That he's taking this position with the governor up there, right? Because she has been very vocal against him, right? And for anybody who is willing to dare challenge him, you're an enemy, right? And he is going to side with anybody who's supportive of him. He doesn't care how racist they are or how bigoted they are. The only time he's ever going to half-heartedly condemn anybody is when he's on the hot seat, and he's still not going to do it because that's his base.
Yeah, he'll generally at that point, he'll claim to not know who they are. Like if it's those David Duke or something. Folks,
those militia folks, those are Trump supporters. That is his core. Right. And to all of the traditional conservative Republicans, right? They represent you too. Those are now your cousins. Okay? They are now your cousins. Thanks to Daddy Trump.
Lindsey Graham is locked in a battle. Jamie Harrison has raised $5 billion or something like that against him. And Lindsey Graham, most of the time when he's on camera these days, he's begging for money. But sometimes he's saying things that are even more unfortunate, including this.
Super President, is that you're not aware of any effort to go back to the good old days of segregation by a legislative body, is that correct?
That is correct. And I've also said that in lectures that Brown was correct as an original matter. So that is the kind of thing, since I've said it in writing, I felt like I could express before the committee.
Okay, so right there, he makes a reference to the good old days of segregation. Now, spoiler alert, he's gonna say that he was being very sarcastic and everything. We'll debate that. But that was obviously while talking with Amy Coney Barrett on day three of her nomination hearing. Gary, what did you think about that little quick reference to segregation in that particular way?
I don't ever think it's a joke. And I think that Lindsey Graham, like most racist white men, find ways to say things that are racist and bigoted and hateful. And then they say, oh, I was just kidding. I wasn't serious. You guys knew I was playing, right? Did we? The good old days of segregation? You know, nothing about that's funny when you talk to a black person. When you recognize that black people were denied the right to use a bathroom, the same bathroom as Lindsey Graham, when black people were denied the right to water fountains. When black people were denied the right to sit where they wanted to in public transportation or to go into a restaurant. The good old days, Lindsey called them, right? There is nothing humorous about that. There's nothing funny about that. And I think that Lindsey Graham is vile. I think that he is clearly a coward, right? He said all of these horrible things about Trump, and now he's just like, you know, Trump's biggest fan, and you know, he supports the president, and you know, that's disgusting enough, right? But then while you're running against a black man who is probably inches away from defeating you, you make a joke about segregation. I hope Jamie Harrison smacks him so hard in this election that he has no chance at redemption. I hope that Jamie Harrison defeats him handedly because he's just terrible. He's terrible, you know, and you know, when we excuse micro racism, that's how we end up with all of the bigots in the streets with guns, because this guy, a United States senator, is saying the good old days of segregation. You know, and for anybody who's saying, oh, he was just joking. Well, let's talk about joking about white folks being in slavery or segregated at any point and see if anybody thinks that's funny.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. No, they think that right now white people are actually the biggest victims in the entire country. Yeah, and so Jamie Harrison tweeted a response saying Lindsey Graham just called segregation the good old days. The good old days for who, Senator? Although of course we know it's 2020, not 1920. Act like it. Although honestly, a lot of people on the right, they don't seem like the way that they talk about race doesn't seem all. It doesn't seem a century apart from 1920. Now, as I said, he says his comments were dripping with sarcasm, and he referred to the era of segregation as dark days. Thing is, like, Lindsey Graham isn't 20. Like, he knows at least some of, you know, the period that we're talking about. Like, we have a couple of comments from continue.
You know, the question I always ask the people who were in the photos with the signs when black kids were integrating schools, where are they now, right? I wonder if there's a picture of Lindsey somewhere where people were integrating and his parents or he were outside, you know, upset about it. Or what was said at Lindsey Graham's kitchen table when schools were integrating, right? Yeah. Because clearly, your family, Lindsey, thought those were good old days, because that joke would never come out of anybody in my family's mouth. Nobody black that I know would ever jokingly say the good old days of segregation. In sarcasm, we would not say the good old days of segregation. And to white voters who think that that is acceptable, it's just wrong on so many levels. But you know, this is par for the course for Lindsey Graham.
Yeah, you know what? That's true. So let's talk about that course a little bit, of the most recent stuff and a little bit going back. So that comment that we played in that video, that comes just days after Graham was criticized for saying during a campaign forum in South Carolina that black people, quote, can go anywhere in this state as long as they are conservative, not liberal. And I still don't know what point he was trying to make. I know what he's saying, and it's awful. And again, as you pointed out, he is running against a black man and repeatedly talking about segregation and how you can run for office, but you have to be a particular sort of person. If you're black, you could run, but you better be conservative. That'll be acceptable. If you're black and liberal, that's not acceptable. Clearly, that's not gonna work. I mean, the entire thing is just horrid.
You know what happens? It's when Republicans are under fire and they're stressed, they just start saying what they really think, you know? And so we see him saying the things that he really thinks, and he's caught on camera saying them, and it's like, wow, Lindsey's really saying these things? Yes, he's saying these things. He believes this. He only wants a Tim Scott, right? Those are the kinds of black people he wants moving around South Carolina. Not people like Jamie Harrison who would dare say, you know, things should change. No, he doesn't want them. He wants a Tim Scott.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, we could have gone through and pulled any number of videos and comments and all that, him saying crazy things. I just pulled a couple to demonstrate who he actually is. So you might recall, not that it's really gone away, the chance to send her back, which targeted Ilhan Omar at a number of Trump rallies, but also, you know, they use the same language against people like Rashida Tlaib and AOC and any number of other black and brown politicians. So he was asked about that. Is it racist to chant that about Ilhan Omar? And he said, I don't think it's racist to say. I don't think a Somali refugee embracing Trump would be asked to go back. If you're racist, you want everybody to go back because they're black or Muslim. That's not what this is about. What this is about to me is that these four congresswomen, in their own way, have been incredibly provocative. So you only would be a racist if you want literally every black person to leave the country. If you only want black people that you disagree with politically to go back out of the country, you know, to a country they haven't been in since they were six, or indeed have literally never lived in, that's not racist. I love racist defining what you would have to do or say or think to be racist. That's always one of my favorite parts of American politics, Gary.
You know, every black person I know has had a moment where some white person has told them, oh, well, you're not like them. Well, who is them, right? What? Because I speak differently, I'm not like the rest of black people, right? Because I can articulate things in a manner that you understand, that means I'm not like the rest of black people, right? Or because this Somali congresswoman, right? Somali American congresswoman, right? Has worked her way up to the US Congress, and here he's calling her provocative? Nah. You know, I can't say what I really think about Lindsey Graham on your platform or on social media, but if you catch me with a camera away, I might just tell you.
I think we get some idea.
I can say trash. I can say that.
Yeah, I want to read one other thing because, and you alluded to this earlier. You know, back during the 2016 campaign, there used to be Republicans who opposed Donald Trump briefly. And Trump is an obvious out and out racist, as explicit as you really can be. And so Lindsey Graham criticized him, calling him xenophobic, racist, bigoted, all of that. Oh, wait, then Trump was in charge of the whole Republican Party. So all of the Republicans that used to criticize him and calling him a big liar and all that stuff have to lick his boots all day long. And so Graham was asked earlier this year if he still considers Trump a racist. And he said, quote, he won the presidency. No, I don't think he's racist. Here's what I think, and I swear to God, this is one of the most unfortunate things I've ever had to say in a graphic. You can be black as coal, and if you like him, he likes you. You can be albino, and if he doesn't like you, he doesn't like you. How the hell could you say that and think that, oh, well, you know, I'm not a racist though. That's insane. It's like shivers up the spine, disgusting.
I've never heard that quote before just now. And as a dark-skinned black man, to hear a white man who is a United States senator refer to some black person as black as coal. If you're black as coal, he'll like you, right? And you like him, he'll like you. That's not the condition to determine whether or not somebody's racist. First of all, why are we talking about complexion, white man? You know, Lindsey's about as pale as they come, okay? And he has the audacity to talk, you know, we have this beautiful melanin skin that is kissed by the sun. And if Lindsey wants to refer to that as black as coal, it is beautiful. It's the most beautiful coal he's probably ever seen. And he's probably envious that he can't shine in the sun as beautiful as that black person's skin. And that's just the reality. And I just can't hear something like that and not truthfully say that he's a disgusting human being, and that's why he does it. He's a spineless individual. That's why he says the things he says, right? Because any man who could go out there and vehemently criticize Trump the way that he did, and now he cowers like a little lap dog, right? Because he's pathetic. He's pathetic. And if South Carolina wants a senator who's a pathetic, worthless individual like Lindsey Graham to represent them, then you get what you vote for.
Yeah. Yeah, and look, I'm not gonna say that Lindsey Graham losing in November would be the best thing that could happen. Obviously, like I would say Trump losing would be bigger. Yeah. Personally, I hate Mitch McConnell as much as anyone in the world. I want him to go down. But Lindsey Graham losing to Jamie Harrison is right up there with the best possible things that could happen in November. And anybody watching this, if you found that quote as abhorrent as I did, I personally felt sick even having to read it. You are not just, you know, just watching to see what happens in that race. You can donate money to Jamie Harrison. I know he's raised more than God himself, but you could still donate more. You could do phone calls, you could tweet about it. Because it would feel amazing to see Lindsey Graham lose. Not just for all the, obviously the racist comments. If you remember his performance during the Kavanaugh hearings, Lindsey Graham is a disgusting human being who deserves to be retired for any number of reasons. Pick one and then help make it happen. That's what I think.
Thanks.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom, In each episode of Un*** the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
All across America, we have, it's just, I don't want to see him. We're going to have to talk about him later on. I don't want to see him right now. Anyway, across America right now, we are locked in this campaign cycle. And what do you know? There are a very large number of black candidates for Senate. And I know, Gary, you wanted to talk about some of these races. So we have a little bit of this information. We're gonna focus on a few. For context, though, I wanted to let people know, there have been 1,307 people who have served in the US Senate throughout its history. Only 10 of them have been black out of 1,307. 6 black non-incumbent candidates won major party nominations for Senate seats. That's this year. Victories for the 5 Democrats and 1 lone Republican would constitute a dramatic increase in representation in a body that's been stubbornly white, wealthy, and male for nearly all of its 200 plus years. So 10 black senators throughout history, a good portion of them quite a while ago, back during Reconstruction, and 6, the vast majority running as Democrats right now, potentially could be a massive change of that number. Although even if they were all successful, it would still be the most wildly unrepresentative thing I've ever heard. But anyway, Gary, what do you think about some of these candidates? Who's particularly drawn your attention in this cycle?
Well, you know, I'm in Louisiana, so Adrian Perkins is running for US Senate here in Louisiana, and he's making up some ground. He's challenging Bill Cassidy here. He's the mayor of Shreveport, Louisiana, and he's been all over the state. I've had the opportunity to meet with him twice in the last 2 months, and I'm impressed with him. He's a Harvard graduate, a West Point graduate, and a young black male who is the mayor of Shreveport, which is the third largest city in the state of Louisiana. And so he's made some ground here. Reverend Raphael Warnock in Georgia is the pastor of a historic church there in Georgia and doing a phenomenal job. He's actually leading in the polls in his jungle primary that he's in. So he'll be in a runoff, I think, in January. And so I think that whatever black folks and liberals around this country can do to help him come January, Perkins will probably be in a runoff December the 5th. And whatever we can do to help them. And of course, we just talked about Jamie Harrison in South Carolina. But I've also got to bring up Mike Espy in Mississippi. Mike Espy is in the blackest state in America, and he's running against Cindy Hyde, right? And she is terrible, okay? If Lindsey Graham's terrible, she's just as equally terrible, right? Cindy Hyde's the one who said at an event that she would go with this guy who was running for office to a public hanging, right? As if that was a joke, you know, like, and Mike Espy is a former member of Bill Clinton's cabinet, a former congressman, and just an all around good guy from everything that I understand. And I just hope that the black folks and liberal folks in Louisiana, Mississippi, South Carolina, and Georgia go handle their business, because beyond just having the ability to beat Donald Trump, we have the ability to make history in many of these states by giving some of these people the opportunity to lead.
Exactly, exactly. And you talked about the qualifications of some of these candidates. I want to talk a little bit more about that. But you know, obviously the individual candidates, a lot of them are absolutely amazing. But let's also remind people. I know it's easy to get hyper focused on the presidential race in a presidential election year, and especially when it's Donald Trump, obviously. But bear in mind that, like, if Biden wins and the Republicans keep the Senate, is that better than the last 3 years? Sure. Is it that much better? Kinda. You're not gonna have a lot getting done over the next few years. So some of these races are gonna be really important. Mike Espy came very close to winning the last time. You know, in a year where things are trending, you know, towards the Democrats, that might be enough to put him over. And I also wanted to say, you mentioned. Particularly about Adrian Perkins, like you said, graduate of Harvard Law School, graduate of West Point, served 3 tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, earning the Bronze Star and the rank of captain. This is great production by our team, and is the grandson of a sharecropper. I mean, what a story. Like, how could you be more qualified as a candidate than those things? It's not to say that I agree on every policy with all these candidates, but it is an amazing slate of candidates being put up in what could be a historic year.
I will tell you that you probably agree more with them than you do any of the people they're running against, right?
I 100%.
That at the core, right, these people have the opportunity to do something special in their states. And when we talk about the future of America, consider this. When Barack Obama was elected to the US Senate, he was the only black senator in the Senate at the time. Then Tim Scott came in, then Cory Booker came in, then Kamala Harris came in. I hate that I mess her name up, I'm sorry. Kamala Harris comes in, right? And so you've got more folks in there at this point, but we have gone decades without representation in this body. And as a result, sometimes just having someone with the cultural competence to have a conversation at the table changes the outcome of policy, right? And as somebody from the South, right, as a black man from the South, in the words of Andre 3000, the South got something to say, okay? And I'm looking to see one of these brothers win and go up there and speak on behalf of a constituency of people who have not been heard in the chambers of the United States Senate.
Yeah, yeah. And there's, you know, I just want to say we talked about a number of candidates. There's one that I wish we could add to that list. I wish that Charles Booker was running against Mitch McConnell. Unfortunately, you know, sort of narrowly lost to Amy McGrath, who would be a massive improvement over Mitch McConnell, obviously, in a million different ways. But like the conversation during the primary was that she was not going to run a vigorous enough campaign against McConnell, that you need someone like Charles Booker. And I would say that watching over the past few months, I think that that was probably right. And you know, we have a quote from Charles Booker that I want to read to you about why a lot of these candidates might be considered underdogs, why generally they don't receive the support of their party during primaries. Amy McGrath was endorsed by the DSCC. He says that the idea that the party tends to approach in these races is that what Dems need to do is they need to win over swing voters. They don't need to, you know, like motivate the base or bring totally new voters in. It's just get some of those Republicans basically to vote for you. And those Republicans are almost always white. So he says, that is often equated to a certain model of a candidate that doesn't include people that look like me and come from where I come from. And it typically involves a style of politics or a political theory that runs away from structural issues, that runs away from racism and poverty, and tries to peel off conservative votes. And I agree with that.
I agree with that 110%. You know, I just watched the state of Louisiana elect a white woman to run the Democratic Party here over a highly qualified Ted James state representative here because they believe that this white woman would bring over white voters into the Democratic Party because they're concerned about losing white voters, right? But there's never really a serious conversation about how do we get all the black folks in the state to vote that already agree with our policies, right? When you look at when Stacey Abrams lost in Georgia, there were a million black people in the metro Atlanta area that did not vote, right? How do you go get those million black folks and get them to the polls? Because the majority of them already think like you, they already agree with you, and their policy points are gonna be in the line. And so I think that trying to convince what they call the soft white vote to cross over, right, I think is wasted energy. And let me tell you why. Because I believe that the white voters who are going to vote for a Biden, who are going to vote for a Democrat, they are going to do it on the principles, not on the personality, right? And I think that those people are there. But the people who are telling you they don't like these candidates that they're forcing down their throat, the people who are telling you that look, I want more from my government, for my communities, for people who look like me, those are the people that were just saying, hey, look, be quiet, just go vote, right? And hence why folks like Ice Cube are out there pushing to get either side to pay attention to black people, right? I think his timing may be off, right? But at this point, the reason black folks are at a crossroads with Democrats is because when you've got a guy like Mr. Booker running, right, you don't take them serious. And so people are willing to say, you know what, all the bets are off. And so the Democratic Party is going to have to recognize that the voices that they need the most are probably the voices that they're just telling to be quiet right now.
Yeah. And in that race, they ignored him. And he came very close to beating Amy McGrath, despite getting, I think he was outspent 81 times over. And so, look, they pumped a huge amount of money in there to get Amy McGrath rather than him, money that could have been saved by putting a tiny fraction of the money into supporting him. And that's in the primary. Are we supposed to expect that there's no effect in the general election? That they're not gonna have to spend tons of money to get some people to reluctantly accept Amy McGrath when they could have had Charles Booker, who did amazingly even without the institutional support? I understand we're way beyond it. There's no way to take that back, and he'll run again in the future. He implied as much the last time we had him on the show. Anyway, that's just one of the most unfortunate things in the primary, a primary that had a lot of unfortunate things going on.
But we've got to talk about that though, John, because that's what gets us the ability to deal with the issues before we end up at the next election, right? So that when Mr. Booker is back up again, that the financial support can be there, so that the political support can be there. Because if Amy McGrath loses, that means you wasted millions of dollars on a failed candidate when you could have gone with this one. And so don't ask people to get behind a duplicate of her in the next go round when you've got somebody that's qualified and ready to go.
Yeah, although that's what they do. I mean, there's a lot of Amy McGraths that have run in a lot of Senate elections over the past 10 or 20 years, unfortunately. Let's say that hypothetically the polls are accurate. We don't know that they are, don't take anything for granted. Go vote, vote.org, tot.com/vote. But let's say hypothetically, we reach November, Biden ends up winning. Let's say that Trump actually concedes and hands over power. Is that the end for Donald Trump? I don't mean, you know, in a cosmic sense, he'll still exist, unfortunately, and he'll probably still be constantly in the news. But if he loses, that doesn't mean that he can't run again. What if he were to bide his time and then in 2024 try again to beat either Biden if he's going for re-election, or, you know, whichever other Democrat ends up running if it's not Biden? Gary, what do you think about that? Do you think that there's any chance that if he loses, Trump will come back in a few years?
No, but I think another Trump could. I think that Donnie's gonna go make his money until he leaves, because you know his speaking fees are probably gonna be through the roof, and he's probably gonna try That's to true. Sign all kind of contracts to do different things, and he's probably still going to attempt to control the Republican Party in large part because it's beneficial for him financially in his mind, right? But I could see, you know, he has brought his entire family into this political sphere, right? And I think that we could see one of his children run. And I think that's even more dangerous than him, because they are of the belief that what their father has done has worked, right? And by all accounts, from their perspective, it has. And so they believe in this same rhetoric, this same ideology. And you know, I could see Ivanka or Don Jr. or any of them deciding that, you know, hey, we're gonna go attempt to run for political office because, you know, political dynasties are a real thing, you know?
Yeah.
It just is, the Bushes, right? The Kennedys, you know, it's not just a Republican or a Democrat thing. It's on both sides that we have seen people build these political dynasties. And once they get one in, you know, there's really a thirst for power that's created, right? Because it's not just about these folks thinking, oh, I'm the best person to lead the country. It's about all that comes with the presidency. And all that the Trump family has benefited off of this, right? They don't want to get out of that spotlight. They don't, yeah. They dare not want to get out of that spotlight. You know, Donnie might want out of the bubble, okay, of being the president, but he's definitely not done with politics if he's defeated. I don't think he runs again just because I think he's aging, and I think he's going to be even more mentally challenged in the next few years. But I could see him bucking up one of his sons or his daughter to do so.
I think that's probably more likely. It is not often the case that a president loses re-election and runs again. The last time it was successful actually was in the late 19th century with Grover Cleveland. So probably not likely to happen. When you said the thing about his speaking fees, I thought immediately, you are so right. And it made me wonder, why isn't he charging for tickets to his rallies? Like, he totally wants to make money off of it. I wonder if he'll just do rallies. Like, he loses, but he just keeps doing rallies and keeps trying to sell tickets. And the best possible thing that could happen out of that is that people do actually lose interest in him and nobody shows up once he starts charging. That would be amazing. But I do think there's a chance of one of his kids. I think that Ivanka is much more sellable. But I don't think that she, like, I believe that she believes a lot of the same xenophobic, bigoted stuff as him. I don't think she's as practiced in selling it in terms of speeches. And that's what I think a lot of people want out of a Trump. I think that Don Jr. is much more willing to do that. But I don't think he has whatever ridiculous thing people see as charisma for Donald Trump that I just don't get. I don't feel like Don Jr. really has that. I know that some of Trump's fans do like Don Jr. But I don't think it's gonna be a lock that he's actually gonna be able to cash in on his dad's brand. Like, he definitely thinks he's going to. He's totally planning to run. I wonder if he's got the juice, if he could actually do what his father did.
So I would just take you back to the Bushes, right? Jeb was supposed to be the one that, you know, had the thunder and could get it done. And then it was George, you know?
Yeah.
The son that was the mess up kid that just, you know, just seemed to keep coming. He becomes governor of Texas. And then, you know, what the hell? He's the president, right? And we saw what came of that. He was not the more astute Bush, but he was the one who won. Because there was just something about George that was able to go out there and talk the language of those people. And I think that if he goes out there and he speaks their language, then they'll jump on. It's not about, you know, how much swag he's got, because George was a goofball, really. You know, if you look at Jeb and George, one was really more professorial, more serious, somebody who, you know, you look like really understood when he was the governor of Florida, really understood what they were dealing with. And George was kind of just like winging it, you know? And that's kind of a thing for Republicans, clearly. They like somebody who's just like, you know, off the cuff and kind of, you know, loose at it, you know, and that was George. And you know, in hindsight, you thought Bush was bad, right? And then you get Trump and you're like, how much worse can it get? Another Trump?
Yeah, maybe. Look, if they're looking for the least astute one, maybe Eric. Maybe it's Eric's time to shine. I don't know. Business Insider, they went to a Trump rally in Pennsylvania and they talked to a bunch of his fans and they asked him this sort of question: what if Trump were to lose, should he run again? And what was interesting was a lot of them, most of them, I think they found one woman who was interested in him running again. These are all people that love Trump. They go to his rallies and everything. A lot of them were saying he would be too old, or they said that they'd want a fresh face, someone new. And names that were offered up were people like Texas Representative Dan Crenshaw, Candace Owens, who's cited here as conservative author, that seems like a weird thing to immediately jump to considering what she's known for, but Candace Owens or Nikki Haley, the South Carolina governor and ex-US ambassador to the United Nations. What was interesting is nobody mentioned Mike Pence as being a potential front runner for the nomination. Man, Mike Pence, he put in the years, he did the work, he supported Donald Trump, and nobody cares that he even exists.
Because who respects a spineless man? Nobody. You know, yeah. even Trump's people, right? I can realistically see Nikki Haley running, though. I think she jumped ship when she did so that she could give herself some space from Trump and give herself the ability to have endeared herself enough to his supporters, but also distance herself enough from him that other folks could take her serious. She tried to walk that line as she was the governor of South Carolina when the shootings happened at the church there. And she brought down the flag at the Capitol after, you know, Bree Newsom snatched it down. Let's be clear. You know, sister went up there and took care of the business before Nikki Haley did it. But I could realistically see Nikki Haley running for the White House. And I think if Trump loses, that, you know, Ron DeSantis is somebody who would probably consider running for the White House. And anyone who's a firebrand Republican right now, you can look to see them jockeying to run for the White House.
What do you think about? So you mentioned, I think, a lot of the politicians that I would cite too. I know that there are others. Although I would say, I would echo what you said, nobody respects a spineless man. That's a warning to you, Ted Cruz. So I know that you think that someday you're gonna run and you're gonna win. Yeah. I think people are gonna remember how weak you were. But what do you think about someone not a politician? Like, they got Donald Trump, who's like a reality show guy. So why wouldn't they then go with someone even more like purely refined right-wing crazy? Like a Candace Owens or a Tucker Carlson or something like that. Someone who's gonna feed them the conspiracy theories, knows, like, they know the grift, they know what they're supposed to say to get the base fired up. What do you think about that group going up against someone like a Nikki Haley or Ron DeSantis, someone like that?
I think that Trump is a uniqueness on his own, right? There may be other people who attempt to duplicate that, but I just don't see a Candace Owens gaining the traction. You've got to remember, Trump was relevant for decades before he ran the White House, right? He didn't just up and decide that, you know, 5 years of being relevant, I'm going to run for the White House. Trump had been relevant in so many different spaces throughout history that, you know, he had name recognition in circles that, you know, some of these people just do not, you know. There are people who still don't know who Candace Owens is. Thank God, right? And, you know, I know she thinks that everybody knows who she is and everybody's talking about her. But honestly, probably beyond right now, I've never had a public conversation about Candace Owens. Why? She's irrelevant to me, right? And I think that people like her will be muted to many people because it's like, who are you? You know, oh, you were a Trump flunky, right? We don't want a Trump flunky per se, right? We want somebody who actually knows a little bit more, because just duplicating Trump isn't going to be enough. He had enough name recognition to give people a real ear to what he had to say prior to him running for office. Now that we've heard what he says, we know that it's racist, bigoted, and ignorant, right? But they still bought it.
I think that you're right. Yeah, I do have to remember that I dwell, because of the job, in a bubble, and I'm exposed to these crazy people more than literally anyone else. And it's not to say that they don't have, you know, they don't have people that'll watch their shows or their podcasts or buy their book or whatever. But that doesn't mean that they have the, like, Donald Trump was on NBC for years and years and years and have been known, you're right, nationwide for decades before that. That's a good point. Okay, maybe we'll return to this in a few years once Republicans start declaring for the presidency. But I like what you're saying there.
I do think Candace Owens is going to run for office, though. I don't think she'll run for the White House. I hope she's not that crazy.
Yeah. Maybe Congress or something. But does she get the, like, they have to do work? Like, it's not just like, my job is just talking to a camera. That's easy. Like, that's what people like me and Candace Owens do. It's harder than that to be an actual congressperson, I think.
So to be clear, a lot of congress people who are not working.
Yeah, that's true. I guess raising money, I suppose. That's true. I think of people like AOC or Ilhan Omar or someone, people putting in the work. But yeah, you're right. I guess not necessarily everybody approaches it in that way.
John, the president doesn't read.
That's true. That's true. Hey, he can't. Okay, I'm sure that if he could, he'd want to. The data seems to be rolling in that indicates that we're about to enter what is being called the third wave of COVID. I would say, let's be clear, we're entering the third stage of the first wave. It doesn't really get to be a different wave if you never got out of it. And since we never did, I'd say it's still kind of the same thing. But I want you to take a look at this. This is a case and hospitalization information going back to the very beginning of the pandemic. We're gonna bring this up and you're gonna see you had that first big hit. Then you had, you know, following the 4th of July, it started spiking once again. And now you can see that as you get to the end of that, cases are creeping up, hospitalizations are going up. We don't yet know for sure about deaths, although they're still effectively nearly as high as they've been at any point here. Yesterday, there were 57,000 COVID cases. That's a 10,000 case increase from one day prior. And there were 809 deaths. So not 1,000, but still a lot. And 37,000 people as of yesterday were hospitalized with COVID-19. And by the way, if we could show you one more chart, you're gonna see the tracking of hospitalization and case numbers, they do tend to go together. It's a bit of a lag, and then deaths tend to lag even more. But anyway, Gary, it's depressing to see after all that we've experienced as a country that it looks like it's gonna get bad again. And that second wave was worse in terms of hospitalizations and cases than the first. There's a chance that this third one might be worse than the second.
You know, it's flu season. People are already in hospitals in large numbers during flu season. I was actually the supervisor of patient transport at a hospital here in Baton Rouge 10 years ago, right? And so I know what hospitals look like during flu season. And when you add a pandemic onto that, you're gonna have hospitals stretched to their max, and that's concerning. But you know, I do believe that we're gonna see a spike because Halloween's coming up and some people are gonna be out tricking and getting a treat of COVID, right? And they're going to end up with situations that because of football, right? Nick Saban has COVID, right? Director at Alabama. You've got football games being postponed, you know, a week later so we can play football next week because people got COVID this week, right? Like our priorities are out of whack at this point, that, you know, sports and entertainment has become more important than survival, you know? And that is, you know, a question that we have to ask ourselves as a society, that, you know, we can't put down these things for temporary moments of discomfort in order to be here longer, right? The scariest part about COVID to me is we don't know what the after effects will be on people in a year, right? We don't know what this will do to people from the medications or the treatments that people are taking as a result of catching this virus, what those impacts will be for a year later, right? And so, no, I am not interested in getting sick, right? And so I still wear my mask, I still social distance. And if you see me without a mask, I am probably around people that I'm very well aware of where they're at and what they're doing, right? Because I take it serious. And I think that because we have a president who had the best healthcare in the world, right? Socialized medicine is what Donald Trump has. Okay, and because he's got the best healthcare in the world and he caught coronavirus and he's okay, then there's a lot of folks who feel like, oh, I'll be fine, right? You don't have Donald Trump's doctors.
Yeah.
You don't have Walter Reed, right? You're willing to risk their life in the car with you. And then they're gonna get amazing healthcare because they still have government insurance also.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't have Walter Reed. Hopefully, you've got, you know, access to healthcare. Like, I'm gonna show you some numbers though, and God, look at this. So this is hospitalization information for four states, for Montana, Nebraska, North Dakota, and South Dakota. You see it shooting up. Now the absolute numbers are not massive there. You see it's hitting about 300 in Montana, but bear in mind there's like 500 people in Montana, so it's pretty bad. I'm kidding. Obviously it's not that bad, but it's pretty bad. And for instance, you have hospitals in North Dakota are nearing capacity. Even just with, you know, a few hundred cases, they just don't have the capacity for so much. Right now, according to the public health director for Bismarck, the state's capital city, they said right now there was just one free ICU bed across the city's two hospitals. And so they are starting to set up again big tents where they can do sort of field medic setup and that sort of thing, which is fine. It's good. It's better than nothing, but it's not Walter Reed. It's not special antibodies. It's not whatever experimental monkey medicine that they put Donald Trump on. He got all the crazy, you know, Dr. House stuff. We're not going to get that if we get sick. So everyone needs to be careful. And Gary, you're totally right. We don't know exactly what the long-term effects are going to be like. I'm sure that CBS is going to do an awesome documentary about it in a year. But now is when we decide if we want to be suffering from those effects that we'll someday learn about. And there's a lot of Americans that have given up. They've been deceived by the media. They've been deceived by their president and told that they don't need to take this seriously. We each get to decide if we're going to be one of those people and how vigilant we're going to be. As I see these numbers go up, I hope that this time the deaths don't follow the pattern the way they have in the previous two. But yeah, we're going to hit it as flu season comes on. Everybody's expecting that the winter is going to be bad. And this is happening right now. We've got a couple of weeks until the election. It's possible that deaths could be spiking in the days leading up to the presidential election. We'll see how much Donald Trump likes that, if it puts people's minds back on his lack of leadership in this pandemic. We're in the closing weeks of this election, and Joe Biden has got an ad out that we're going to show you in full, because I think it really does summarize what his appeal is to people, both the actual appeal that people are feeling and also what he wants them to feel. Now, it is not necessarily perfectly targeted to a progressive like me in terms of being founded in policy, but I do think that it could be pretty effective. So we're going to watch it right now and discuss. This is one of the last Joe Biden ads.
There's a new world coming, and it's just around the bend.
It's time for America to get back up.
There's a brand new morning.
We can build a more perfect union
that belongs to you and me.
The days of divisiveness.
Yes, a new world
will soon be over.
That belongs to you.
Let's get back up.
Yes, a new world.
We're decent, we're brave, we're resilient people.
Come on, Joe. Come in
and we can't believe again.
I'm Joe Biden, and I approve this message.
Okay, so Gary, I'm really excited to see maybe if we disagree on this. What did you think about that ad?
Nina Simone. I am a huge Nina Simone fan, and so as a progressive, right, to know what she stood for, whoever made that ad was speaking to folks like me right there, right? And I thought it was good. I intentionally did not watch the ad before the show because I felt like I wanted to be authentic in my response to it, right? And my biggest takeaway was hearing Nina Simone and the imagery that matches, right? I think that at the core, all Black people, all American people, all Hispanic people, white people who are of pure intentions want to see that version of America, right? They want to see an America where, you know, our children have a future. They want to see an America where they see men, women, and people of all orientations walking together and progressing in this life and through their journey. And there's some type of human connection to that, right? And to have it laced with Nina Simone, I think it is a powerful image. I hope that it speaks to the heart of people to remind them of what we can be and not what we are.
Yeah. And look, obviously the reality is that, let's say that works, that America that we'll be getting back to is gonna have about 1 billion problems that we're gonna have to go right back to work on trying to fix. But the reason I think that this is gonna be so successful, and this is sort of what I was saying back in 2016, when I know that there was this debate about whether it was better to have, you know, Donald Trump get in rather than Hillary Clinton, so that hypothetically a strong progressive would eventually run against Donald Trump in 2020, that it would give rise to this. And I remember saying over and over, like, people are going to be so beaten down by how unrelentingly awful these years are going to be, that they are going to want to just go back to something that seems sane, something that seems decent in any way, something that seems relatively close to the truth, all of these things. And I think that Joe Biden does represent that to a lot of people. People are exhausted. They were exhausted before 2020, the most exhausting decade of our life. And then this has just beaten out the last bit of tolerance they have for any more of this time. And so that ad was not full of a ton of, it wasn't about Medicare for all, it wasn't about a Green New Deal, it wasn't about infrastructure reform, it wasn't about criminal justice. I mean, it was about those things, but not specific. But I think that's what people want right now. That's what we've been given by a combination of Donald Trump and 2020. They just want to feel like we're going to have a person who is not literally among the worst people on the planet right now in charge of everything. And that's why I can see that being an effective ad for a lot of people.
I would agree 100%. I think that, you know, as we wind down, you know, the policies aren't where people are making their decisions today. They're making their decisions based on, you know, is this someone that I believe can manage the job, right? And where are you taking us, right? I think we've had all of the policy debates. I don't think 3 weeks out from an election that people are deciding, you know, based on Joe Biden or Donald Trump's policies that they're gonna vote. They're gonna vote because they wanna say, this person has the ability to take this nation where I want it to go. And for conservative Republicans, that's down a rabbit hole of racism and bigotry. And for everybody else, it's towards at least some sort of normalcy and hope for a better tomorrow.
Yeah, 100%. I'm surprised. I thought maybe we would disagree. Over the nearly last 2 years or so, we've had many candidates on the show and we've had requests for many more, but I don't think anyone has received as many specific requests as the congressional candidate who joins us on the show now, running in Florida's 3rd district, Adam Christensen. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Well, thanks. That's a little terrifying. I don't know how to feel about that one.
Well, if you don't deliver, then they're going to be disappointed.
That's what I'm saying. There's a lot of pressure there.
No pressure at all. But there's obviously a lot of enthusiasm. And so you haven't been on the show before. So let's talk a little bit about how you decided to launch this campaign. You know, we have a lot of first time candidates who come on the show. You're younger than most of them. I'm sure you're absolutely sick of talking about your age, but tell me a little bit about the decision to run in the 3rd district.
Yeah, I mean, I am actually the youngest Democratic nominee in the country right now, which is, again, terrifying. But really, I got into this kind of because I started two companies in Gainesville, Florida, and they're both essentially catching fraud, catching people, international suppliers trying to screw over family-owned businesses. And what I kind of realized is that we have that with our entire world, where we have the best marketing, the best, you know, distribution, but we don't have the best products anymore. Most of them, the majority of them, are fake or fraudulent. And so when I looked at the race that was gonna happen, I didn't see anybody who could talk about that, who was talking about actual systemic issue, and on top of that would actually be able to put up a fight or actually be able to make a change. So our entire campaign pretty much throughout the entire primary was run by young people. It was everyone under the age of 23 and I was the old person. And so that is really what we focused on, is the things that were affecting our lives and the people around us. And that is why so many people love what we are doing, is because we're not focused on a 24-hour news cycle. We're focused on the things that actually affect our lives. And so it's been incredible. It's been 9 months. We got into it 6 months after everybody else, and yeah, here we are.
Yeah, and in the home stretch, I know that in, and maybe this relates to what you're talking there about the reason you launched it. You talk about in some of your campaign advertisements, the sort of the lingering long-term effects of the 2008 recession. We're sort of experiencing a second version of that for a lot of young people whose lives were set back in 2008. We now have a version of that for people today. So, you know, with that as part of the background of your run, what are some of the policies that you're highlighting as sort of the core of your campaign?
Yeah, I mean, we all remember what happened after 2008, right? You had a populist movement that sprung up. One was somewhat the Tea Party, not really a populist movement, but it happened. And then you also had Occupy. Now, with what is everything that has happened so far with the pandemic and everything else, we're gonna see that again. The question is, are we gonna come out of this pandemic and out of this bailout again and out of this stimulus package focused on people? Or are we gonna focus on banks and airlines and the same things that we did in 2008? Because most people feel like they got screwed over in 2008. They still have that feeling. The people that I talk to, they're still not recovered from that. But we have the biggest companies in the world that are not only recovered, but they're doing better than ever. And yet we never got a return of that money that we feel like, you know, we gave. So for a lot of people, they're just feeling like, you know, if we pay taxes, we should be getting something back for that. We should be getting a return on the investment that we keep making, but we haven't. And our lives keep getting harder and everything's more expensive. And so one of the biggest things that we focused on, there's a couple of things. Number one, I need to make sure everybody has healthcare. As we've seen with the pandemic, if one person doesn't have healthcare, everyone is at risk. And on top of that, we have to make sure that essentially, and this is what our entire campaign has boiled down to, it's the rallying cry. It's, if you are working 8 hours a day, you should be able to afford a home, you should be able to start a family, and you should have money left over. And a lot of people just do not have that anymore. And so all of our policies are focused on that one specific idea. A big one that a lot of people on our campaign specifically love is the fact that we're gonna go after predatory debt. For some reason, we're not allowed to buy alcohol or cigarettes or enlist in the military when we're 17, but kids all across the country are allowed to bring on $200,000 of debt from a private company, and they will never pay that back. And nobody's protecting them. And on top of that, they're not able to buy homes now because they have so much debt. And so we want to eliminate that. We want to make it so we have the biggest housing boom in the United States history. And eliminating student debt would be one of those ways.
So you mentioned a few issues there. One is healthcare, and we're currently at a situation where we have the ACA. It's got a lot of problems. Obviously, we're looking at a potential future with Amy Coney Barrett and Trump, where hypothetically it could be overturned either legislatively or judicially. Hypothetically, let's say you get elected, Joe Biden gets elected. What are you going to be pushing for in terms of the future of healthcare policy?
Well, we all understand that the issue that happened, especially through the Obama years, was that the team that he had around him, people like Rahm Emanuel, they essentially said that, well, number one, we don't know how to negotiate. And number two, we're not gonna actually fight for things. And so they didn't even get a public option. What Joe Biden needs to do is he actually needs to go further. If you go for Medicare for all, you're gonna get a public option. If you go for nationalized healthcare system, you're gonna get Medicare for all. I think everybody understands that that's the way that you negotiate. And Republicans have understood this for a very long time. For me, the way that I frame it, especially running in a Republican area, it's a plus nine here. The way I frame it is almost in a conservative narrative, because here's the deal, right? You got middlemen right now that we pay 30% to and they do nothing. They are the insurance companies. And if you remove them, you have now just gotten rid of bureaucracy. You just got rid of red tape. You just got rid of middlemen and you are able to help stop price fixing. That sounds pretty conservative to me. And at the same time, you now have a free market because you get to go choose your doctor and you get to go choose your hospital and nobody else chooses for you. And so when you frame it like that, it actually, you know, it starts to take a lot of meaning, especially for people around here. And they're like, I'm okay with that. And then you go a step further. You say, look, right now, your small business has to pay $8,000 per employee for healthcare. And you can't expand, you can't recruit, you can't grow. And every small business I know gets to a certain point where they have to start providing benefits and they can't. And they either sell and try to get out before the whole thing collapses, or they effectively just peter out. And so Medicare for all, removing those insurance companies would be a small business tax cut. The Supreme Court said with the ACA that premiums and deductibles are taxes. So we need to start treating them like it if it comes from the government or if it comes from a private company.
And so when you use that sort of framing on it, how do the small business owners, how do they receive that?
Oh, they love it. I mean, they get $8,000 back in their pocket immediately and that can go back to wages. And they actually understand that, look, when you invest in your people, you're gonna be able to grow. And when you have people that can take a risk, this is the most important part. Right now, people cannot take a risk. They cannot leave and start their own company because if their kid gets sick, they go bankrupt.
Mm-hmm. And so that's a great example of how to make one sort of policy that's been demonized on the right appealing to more conservative voters. Is that the trick? Because as you pointed out, it's a redder district. You're going to be running to replace the outgoing Republican Congressman Ted Yoho, which people might remember from earlier this year, his interaction with Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Interaction is the nicest spin on it. Is that what you're having to do with other policies too?
I wouldn't say have to, I'd say choose to, because we had an option, right? And this is what every Democrat has always had the option to do when you run in a Republican district. You either go effectively, you go moderate, which means you water down your policies, or you figure something else out. Now, what we have done is actually more challenging, but more exciting. We have refused to water down our policies, and instead we decided that we were gonna play with optics and marketing and do something that nobody has ever done, which is effectively run on an extremely progressive platform, but make it seem like it's an extremely conservative one, which honestly, it is classical conservatism. You go after monopolies, you go after price fixers, and you fight off people like JP Morgan or Rockefeller, just like they used to do back in the day. You go after these people that have destroyed the free market. That is progressivism. That is economic progressivism. It's also classical economic conservatism. And there's huge parallels there. And so we find the parallels. And so when people ask us, well, how do you reach across the aisle? We say, we already are. We've got hardcore Republicans in High Springs partnering with environmentalists to fight off Nestle. We've got hardcore Republicans in Union County, one of the poorest counties in the country, partnering with environmentalists to fight off phosphate mines. Because it's about their community and it's about themselves and it's about making sure that their way of life doesn't get destroyed by people coming in and taking their money, taking their health, and just wiping it off the face of the planet. And so that's what we focus on, is people. And everyone seems to really resonate with that, especially when you frame it as, look, I don't care who you are. I just care about how we can build each other up and how we can actually have a community that we can be proud of. And that's really how we frame it.
Let's talk about one other person though, your opponent in this race, the former legislative aide to Representative Yoho. Yeah. Kat Kamak, I believe it's pronounced, I'm not entirely sure.
So Fox News called her Kate. I'm really not sure at this point what I think her actual name is Catherine. I'm not sure.
Okay. So what is she bringing to the table?
So I don't know if you've seen anything that's been going on, but we actually may have stumbled into one of the biggest political scandals in Florida politics history, which is just fantastic. So we've been having a lot of fun with this. We put out our first video, which was essentially called, and this was the hashtag, it was Where's the Cattle Ranch? So her life story is that she grew up in Colorado on a cattle ranch and a farm. And in 2011, she was bankrupted by Obama, and then she was homeless. And from that, she became Ted Yoho's campaign manager, and then eventually a 24-year-old chief of staff in Washington, DC. And then she decided to run for Congress when he decided to retire. The whole thing is completely fake, and we found out it was completely made up so she could run for Congress. She didn't grow up on a cattle ranch. We found the property records. She was not bankrupted by Obama. She actually bankrupted herself when she took a 108-day cruise when she had $350,000 in debt. And on top of that, she was never homeless. She had an $800 apartment, which was apparently so beneath her that she called it, quote, a crack house to a local newspaper. On top of that, when she did get to Washington, she was the chief of staff for Ted Yoho until there was an incident. We know what the incident was, but we're waiting for it to come out in the papers. At which point she was fired by Yoho and sent back to Gainesville, Florida, but he kept her on the payroll. She created her own private consulting company, which was called Grit Strategies, and she started to receive money from Yoho there as his only client. And her husband's lawn mowing company also started to receive money from Yoho. So she had three different revenue streams, was making more money after she got fired than before. And then somehow she also got into the Naval War College with a letter of recommendation from the guy who fired her. And the best part about the whole thing, he has still refused to endorse her. And his son came out and said that basically her ambition was bigger than her integrity. and that she was fired and that they don't want to have anything to do with her. So there's scandal after scandal here, and we have pointed it out, and we, like, right now it is just incredible what is going on, and it's incredible what our team has been able to find, because, like, as I said earlier, my job is essentially to catch fraud. It is to look through marketing BS and save people from getting screwed over. And so we're just letting our work speak for ourselves. We have found this, and there are ethics complaints right now that have been filed or are being filed in the congressional ethics office. And these are gonna start coming out because this is a big deal. And the way politics has been, we need people to stand up and expose it and be able to speak truth to power and actually show the way that things have been and how we can change it. And that's really what we have been focused on. And it's kind of incredible.
Oh, well, I'm gonna be eagerly awaiting some of the details coming out from that. Just to briefly focus on, I think obviously the most important part of that, 108-day cruise. Yeah. I didn't know that those existed. I would get so bored, I think. But anyway, wow, that is an amazing life story, both the one that was told and whatever it turns out that the truth actually is. So look, we've covered a little bit about your platform. Obviously, there's a lot more to it. If people watching this would like to get more information about your campaign, where can they do that?
Yeah, so our website is called ForTheManyNotJustMe.com. And that's really been our slogan, our rallying cry, that everything that we are doing is for all of us, not just me as a candidate, not just us as a campaign. And when you got a lot of people that stand up and say that what we are fighting for is for the many, not just me, that becomes a huge movement. And so that is our website. You can find our platform. We just dropped a jobs plan with all of our great ideas, but how they would actually be done here. And our Twitter is pretty active. Our Facebook is active. And if you want to find out where the cattle ranch is, you can go find that out as well.
Thank you so much, Adam. Really appreciate you joining us today.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.